May it please the court.
You may proceed.
I have to cough. It's my very first act. I've handed out for your honors a ballot title for the Senate Joint Resolution 36, and you have a copy in front of you. The question before this court is this ballot summary a fair and impartial explanation of the changes that the voters will vote on to the Missouri Constitution? And if it's not, what are you going to do about it? When one reads this title, the question is, one reads this title, does it let the voters know that we are enshrining in the Constitution a change of the judicial standard of review to impose the highest standard of review, strict scrutiny, which has not previously been the standard? And does it let the voters know that we are removing language from the Missouri Constitution that allows the regulation of carrying of concealed weapons? If this constitutional change is adopted, Missouri will be only the second state in the country to impose a strict scrutiny standard of review on gun regulation.
Now, clearly you acknowledge that ballot titles don't have to encompass everything within the subject of the initiative. Is that true?
Absolutely.
All right.
I think that both sides agree that a ballot title does not need to cover the details. And I believe we agree, there are several briefs, that it should cover the major points in a way that fairly summarizes.
What's the percentage of voters that know what strict scrutiny means?
Well, that's an interesting question, Judge. I don't know the answer to that question. It would be true to tell them what strict scrutiny meant. Here's how Louisiana dealt with it. When Louisiana passed the exact same measure, Louisiana Act No. 874 of the regular session of 2012, Louisiana adopted a strict scrutiny standard in their constitution. They chose to say that the right requires the highest standard of review by a court. To me, that seems like a fair summary. But I think the question is not what do you say. We may need to get to that today, and I'm happy to discuss it. But is it enough to simply say what you have in front of you? There will be an inalienable right, and the state shall uphold it. Does that alert voters in any way that we're moving to strict scrutiny? In the briefs, and certainly below, the state and some of the other respondents argued that by saying inalienable, by using the word inalienable.
Inalienable or unalienable?
Either. Okay. Inalienable, I think. No, we say unalienable here. Anyway, by using that word, that you're alerting voters that you're moving to strict scrutiny. And if they don't understand strict scrutiny, it's much harder to understand what the effect of inalienable is. The effect of the word inalienable has no legal meaning, as we argued in our brief. Three states have the phrase inalienable right in their constitution. In all three of those states, their Supreme Courts have said specifically that the use of the word inalienable does not trigger strict scrutiny standard and that they will review those under rational basis.
What's Black's Law Dictionary definition of inalienable?
Of inalienable, a right that may not be taken away. Normally used in the context of contracts and inalienable rights to et cetera. Of course, the word inalienable comes, Judge Tottenham, from our Declaration of Independence. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are inalienable rights. Of course, we may regulate the pursuit of happiness, and we do so every day, without strict scrutiny standards. Liberty is also, depending on what liberty you're taking. So the fact that a right's inalienable, or even fundamental, the fact that a right's fundamental does not automatically mean strict scrutiny. And the cases are pretty clear on that. We cited a Law Review article that does an excellent summary. In this court's decision in State versus Richard, you examined what the constitutional provision means. In the majority opinion, written by Judge Teitelman, you talked about reasonable use of police power. In the concurrence, Judge Fisher wrote presciently that the Second Amendment does apply to the states, with which the Supreme Court later agreed in McDonald. But Judge Fisher's concurrence does not use a strict scrutiny standard either. He says the right is fundamental, but he does not use a strict scrutiny standard of review there either. Saying inalienable tells us nothing. It tells the voters nothing about the change that we're making to the Constitution. Judge Fisher, to your question, there are many things. I agree with the state. There are many ways to explain this, but not explaining it is wrong. It's wrong to ask the people to change a constitutional provision that has been this way for 150 years and that this court has analyzed several times already in very important cases And we're going to change that forevermore and enshrine it in the Constitution. So I think we agree it has to hit the high points. And I think we agree that it can't just, or that it can, I'm sorry, can skip the details, can hit the high points. In rereading the briefs over the weekend, and we've moved pretty quickly, so when I read it, I thought, well, how is the court supposed to know what's a major point and what's a detail? And you can look and make, you do this every day, make that judgment. But there is some other jurisprudence that you may wish to consult in figuring out what's a major point and what's a detail. The State's Unlawful Merchandising Practices Act, which this court reviewed in Hess versus Chase Manhattan Bank, says that it is unlawful to sell anything, sell a magazine in this state, and omit a material fact, which is defined by law as a fact which a reasonable consumer would likely consider to be important in making the decision. Would a reasonable voter likely to consider it to be important that we're removing the carry and conceal language that Judge Limbaugh relied on in the Brooks case to say that the right does not extend to carry and conceal weapons? Would a reasonable voter want to know that we were applying strict scrutiny?
But isn't the requirement that we have to look at in analyzing this summary, is does it fairly and sufficiently?
Correct.
And so that's our standard.
It is. So I skipped a step. So is it fair and sufficient? Does it, the Coburn versus Mayer case, the Court of Appeals case, talks about the duty to educate, that may not be the exact words, but to explain to the voters what's happening. The word summary is important. It's not just fair and sufficient, it's a fair and sufficient summary. So I guess what I'm trying to get to is how do we determine when a summary is fair and sufficient?
And you're saying it has to have all material facts, but we're kind of going in circles.
A little bit. We have to figure out what the material facts are.
Do other jurisdictions provide any guide for us as to how to determine what's key, and do they have the same limitation on words that we have?
I'm not aware of any. The two that I would suggest are, again, the Merchandising Practice Standard, and then the other line of cases that may not seem intuitive is the cases that where this court discusses Brady disclosures, and this court discusses the standard that's required when a fact was not disclosed by the prosecution. And this court has said in Engle versus Dormeyer, more recently in Woodworth versus Denny, that the question is there a reasonable probability that a different result would have been had the fact been disclosed?
And what we're talking about, the ballot proposal is on the ballot. We're just talking about the explanation, the summary of it. And so what do we do about it? 28 of the 50 words we used, what do we do about if we... It's on the ballot. How do we deal with the summary then?
This is an important point, Judge Titleman. The text does not appear on the ballot. The text of the full measure does not appear on the ballot. All the voters see on the ballot is this summary statement that I handed out.
Right, but the text is what's going to be voted on.
Correct. The text
You're saying
is,
the voters only see this and they think this is what they're voting on. And
yes.
The question is this a fair and adequate summary of what in fact would be enacted should they vote it.
But don't polling places have a copy of the full text of any measure on the ballot?
They do. As required by law, while you're voting, if you get to an initiative, and I say this somewhat facetiously, I understand. If you get to an initiative and you don't understand it, you can lay your pen down, walk away from your ballot, walk all the way over to the other side of the gymnasium, sort through all of the amendments that'll be on the ballot, and find that one. It's also published in the newspaper. Mm-hmm. But it's only published in the newspaper 4 weeks before the election. So if I got an absentee ballot at the 6 week mark, I haven't ever seen the full text mm-hmm. of the
ballot. Probably couldn't Google it and find it, could you?
Well, might be able to if you can navigate the Secretary of State's website.
That's we wouldn't have a fair and adequate summary requirement unless we thought voters needed to have something that's fair and adequate.
Correct.
How detailed have we ever required these summaries to be in order to meet that standard?
Well, we have the Court of Appeals has written that it shall cover all of the main points. And we've cited cases where the Court of Appeals has dealt with the issue. I don't know that this court has ever said add this or subtract that. Ms. Follett would like to argue for the remaining two.
She didn't quite yank your arm.
Use a stick. I think one of the things as the court looks in how to apply the standard before it and to determine if this title is fulfills the requirements, we have to look also at 116.155.2. which requires the title to be a true and impartial statement of the purposes of the proposed measure, using this language that is not intentionally argumentative nor likely to create prejudice. This statute is different from previous versions of title requirements. If you go back to very early in our state's history, for example, I think it is Section 7122, 1899 statute, ballot titles at that point said they should state or indicate the character or nature of the proposed amendment. We had changes over the years moving to different language. The current language, I guess, was fairly close to what we had in the 1980s, which says the title shall be a true and impartial statement of the purposes. I think it's very important that we have plural purposes that's used in the statute. At that point in the 80s, it was limited to a 35-word summary. We've moved up to 50 words. When you look at what the meaning of the word purposes is here, I think it's important to juxtapose this to the subject of an amendment. As you know, the Constitution limits changes to those having a single subject. So if it's, we're talking about the purposes that need to be in here, it has to be something more narrow than what the general overarching subject is. We can also look at the dictionary. Webster's New 20th Century Unabridged, which is slightly older version than what you have upstairs in the third, but is consistent, says that a purpose is that which a person sets before himself as an object to be reached or accomplished, aim, intention, or design. It's also the end in view, the object for which something is done. This court also very recently in the Brown versus Carnahan case tied the requirements of 116, 115 to the insufficient unfair standard, and it describes what a adequate, fair and adequate summary must do. And this court said the language should fairly and impartially summarize the purposes, again, plural purposes of the measure, so that the voters will not be deceived or misled. I have just a few seconds, but I wanted to just
What should we do if we were to take your position that it doesn't describe the purposes. What do we do? We send it back to the Secretary of State? What do we do with it?
We really didn't. They said it needed to go back to the legislature. We said either one. I said for sure it needs to be vacated. I think the statute fairly read says the courts should rewrite it so that it's fair and sufficient. One of the things I want to say is that there's sort of two classes of cases in previous ballot titles. Some of these are from the Court of Appeals, some from this court. There's those that say when it gives wrong information, it needs to be corrected, and that those cases falling in this category might be Missouri Municipal League, the 2010 decision from the Court of Appeals, and then Cures Without Cloning, where the Western District basically took out and rewrote the part that was wrong. And then there's some that where people said information is missing. Now, one, the United Gamefowl Breeders case from this court in 2000 was actually a clear title case, and it made, the court made an observation about what 116, 190 means, but the I don't know that was really the subject of it. This court's decision in Brown versus Carnahan is really the authoritative interpretation of what 116, 190 means.
And counsel, how many times has this court ever found a ballot summary to not meet these standards?
The current standards? Well, there are very few cases from this court itself because these typically go to the Western District. And at least twice, Missouri Municipal League and then the Cures Without Cloning versus Pund, the Court of Appeals has rewritten. I think there may be one or two other cases. I don't have them right in front of me, but it has certainly occurred.
And are those cases where they affirmatively, where the summary affirmatively misstated the provision?
Well, in the Missouri Municipal League, the Court of Appeals took out a part that suggested that the summary would do something that was already part of the law in Missouri. So that was requiring fair compensation when they're taking. Here, I think we're not strictly saying that there is missing information, but that I believe the title affirmatively indicates something wrong because it says it would make a declaration that a right that has existed in this state for unchanged for 140 years, that right is to be declared unalienable and the state's supposed to uphold that. But what it does is it changes the right, and it wrongly suggests that It's making a declaration that the right as it currently exists is being made unalienable when, in fact, it is the changed right, significantly changed right, if this is adopted, that would be made unalienable. So I believe it is incorrect and not simply a matter of details. And then those that talk about the details, if you would indulge me for just a moment, those are typically even ones where the Secretary of State typically has used up all the words. And then it's an argument about, well, you really should have included this and not that. And the Court of Appeals says, well, obviously we can't put everything in. We got 100 word limit for statutory ones. And we can't add everything. So if it's just going to be an argument about putting more in and we're already at the limit, we're not going to find that it's a problem. But here we've got under-inclusive, wrong information.
Is it significant that the legislature wrote the summary rather than the Secretary of State? Does that impact our analysis?
Well, the General Assembly has to follow the law, too. So the if this is not living up to the fair and sufficient standard and the requirements in 116.155.2, it doesn't matter who wrote it. If it falls below that standard, the court cannot let that proceed.
What about the disenfranchisement of the absentee voters or the military voters?
Well, that issue is not really before the court. The suggestion has been made that some voting has started. The majority of voting has not occurred. 116.190 does not set time limits for this. But I would say that both with absentee ballots, you can it's just the time period for getting them has started. It is not concluded. It is not if someone cannot go get an absentee ballot later, so they could get one under a correct title. And I believe that's, I'm no expert on military voting, but I believe that there's a portal that allows people to register and get their absentee ballots and other things like that, and it's the time frame has started but has not concluded for that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you,
Honors.
Counsel.
May it please the Court, Your Honor.
May proceed.
There are two principal issues in this case, actually. The first is whether the case is moot, because the court cannot place an individual or an issue on the ballot less than 6 weeks before the election, which is the case here. And the second is whether the General Assembly's summary is an unfair or insufficient summary because it left off two details that are not necessary to make the subject evident with sufficient clearness to give notice of the purpose to those interested or affected by the proposal. I thought I'd address the mootness issue briefly to the court. The General Assembly indicated in the provision Senate Joint Resolution 36 that it should be set on the November or ballot or a special election. The governor, however, set it for the August primary, which is his right to do. Constitutionally, he can do that. But what it means is that there are certain remedies that may not be available, and such is the case here. Section 115.125 limits court's ability to put issues on the ballot. And the question is, what does that language mean, to place an issue or individual on the ballot? Certainly, we all can agree that is there an entirely new ballot summary, that would be putting an issue or individual on the ballot. The question
one,
in this
one
case,
of the opposing briefs said this doesn't apply to primary elections because they're not special elections, they're preset elections. And that wasn't really addressed in your briefs. Can you address that?
That this provision doesn't apply to primary elections?
As shown by, they said that it was put on the ballot less than 10 weeks in advance certified, and that same provision requires things to be certified. If it's less than 10 weeks, must be certified by court order.
Right. There's no qualification in 115.125 that it says that contrasts with that provision. So that it would have to be us trying to determine, or the court trying to determine, whether or not that supersedes or that imposes an additional restriction on that. But there's nothing in the statute that says that provision applies to this type of challenge or this type of mootness claim under it. So I don't know if I can answer that question precisely, but I don't. There's nothing in the
statute. I don't want to take up too much of your time.
Yeah,
with that.
No, there's nothing in the statute that suggests that it would apply. In our estimation, with respect to whether or not they can revise something, And that's really where we are in this case, whether or not they can, whether or not something can be revised for the summary statement. That issue is, the question is whether or not revision is putting an issue on the ballot. If we look at the language of the statute, I think it certainly does that. For one, it doesn't say in the statute that it has to be a new issue. Second, the issue encompassed by the provision is not only just the ballot measure, but also the summary statement. By putting a revised one on, it's putting an issue on the ballot. So our argument would be that it is moot. But I want to move instead.
But what about the public policy exception?
Public policy of?
If it is moot, then what about the exception, the public policy exception?
Again, I don't know that it applies in this case. It doesn't.
Address it anyway.
Whether you should address it or not.
Uh-huh.
Certainly there is this court. We are in favor of putting things on the ballot. But within the context of a ballot initiative, the only constitutional provisions provide for that right. These statutory provisions are subject to being excluded or subject to being, in this case, the governor set it for the August primary, which by that constitutional act, limited the remedies that may be available. And so I don't believe under these circumstances, because of that constitutional authority to put it on the ballot, would implicate any public policy.
They still have a remedy after the election.
Yeah, they may have
their arguments.
That's right. That's right. And that's what we asserted in response to the temporary restraining order, that they would have a remedy by virtue of not counting the votes, if you will. That's a challenging one for sure. If something is passed to take it away, that's a challenging one. But that is
how
a remedy.
How often has that been as successful?
How often has that been successful?
Right.
I'm not aware that it's been successful. There certainly have been times where things have been in the Thompson case, this court obliterated fiscal note because of the authority of the legislature, not lack of authority of the legislature to delegate that, but I'm not aware that a post-election result has occurred, or that post-election.
Council, even if this court were to agree that it's too late to change the issue, because that would be like putting an issue on the ballot, what about removing it from the ballot, which isn't addressed?
Yeah. Section 115.125 says nothing about removing, and
right.
so we can't really make a determination based upon that. Now, having said that, the Court of Appeals in the Cole versus Carnahan case addressed that and concluded that Section 116.190 does not provide for a remedy of removal from the ballot.
Why not?
It's not explicit.
There is another provision that talks about that by court order you can remove candidates from the ballot.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, actually, in 115.379, I think it talks about if a candidate is disqualified, they actually remain on the ballot. If they remain on the ballot, and they won't be seated. But so that suggests that it should or can remain on the ballot.
Or does it suggest that some other provisions refer to removal from the ballot, but this one doesn't? It simply says that within 6 weeks you can't add something and issue a candidate to the ballot, and doesn't say you can't remove them. The legislature knew how to say remove when they wanted to, and they didn't hear.
I agree with that,
Who,
Your Honor.
Who prints the ballots?
Who prints the ballots? Local election officials.
Well, has the opposing party named any local election officials to this lawsuit?
No, they haven't.
So how would any order entered by this court affect them?
I don't know the answer to that one. The order that could be entered would be simply against the Secretary of State, which sends the information or certifies the information to the local election authorities, but doesn't print the ballots. Those are all done by the local election authorities.
And what's really not printed ballots anymore, or are they all on the computer?
What's that? No, there are still ballots printed, to be sure. But there are touch screens available. There's different ways to vote, but there are still ballots available.
If I ask for a printed ballot, I can't get one in my voting booth.
Is that right?
They'll give me. They thought I'd get a provisional ballot.
Oh, provisional.
I won't get a real ballot if I can't use the computer.
You should move to a different county then, I suppose.
Yeah.
That's the answer. That just
come on up, Rick. We still have paper where I live.
I didn't answer your question, Judge Wilson. I apologize.
Is there a statute that allows the Secretary of State to give a certification this late?
No, there's not a provision that I'm aware of that gives the Secretary of State authority, aside from some of these exceptions where it's where somebody's disqualified or something like that, that allows them to certify, particularly a ballot title measure. So I wanted to address really quickly this. I don't mean to cut you off.
No, go ahead.
I want to address really quickly the summary statement. They appear to have not abandoned, but certainly didn't address the issues, the first issue that they argued with respect to the fairness and sufficiency of the language. Their claim has been that it restates existing rights, which it does not in this case. It says the right is to be considered unalienable. And it also elevates that right, which gets me to the claim that they have made by that is that by excluding the reference to strict scrutiny, by excluding the concealed carry defense that is raised in the Constitution, that makes it unfair and insufficient. But it does not. The purpose of this is to give notice to the voters of the purpose of the ballot measure. And here, that purpose is fairly expressed by saying that this includes a declaration that the right, which is the right to keep and bear arms, is unalienable. As you indicated, Judge Fischer, most people would not necessarily understand what strict scrutiny is. It's a legal concept. Certainly there would be some. But most people would understand the weightiness of an unalienable right, even though it's not necessarily described sufficiently in many courts, and certainly not in this court, what that really means. But what it does communicate, what it does put them on notice, is that it elevates that right.
Do you have any way of discerning empirically that people would understand unalienable more than they would strict scrutiny?
I don't think there's any way to empirically determine that. My own estimation of it is most people, because of their familiarity with the Declaration of Independence, would recognize unalienable or inalienable, whereas most probably would not recognize strict scrutiny and what that means. Interestingly, the proposal that was made by the Dotson plaintiffs included strict scrutiny but made no mention of unalienable. I suppose the inverse of that is they're demonstrating that strict scrutiny is a counterpart for unalienable, so they don't have to include it.
We don't have a situation here where there were just so many facts and you couldn't fit them all in, and so some had to get left out and you're fighting about which ones. There were 22 words out of 50 not used.
That's true.
There were a lot of other things there are a lot of other things in here that are not mentioned that could have been mentioned in those 22 words.
That's true, Your Honor. But what I would say to that is that the point of what the General Assembly is trying to do is communicate the purpose of this, and to diffuse that with other things, potentially in their mind, is.
So there's no purpose to the other changes?
No, there is purpose, but they are not the principal. These are not the purposes that. Well, I guess I should rephrase it the other way, and that is by excluding those, it does not make the summary unfair and insufficient. Certainly, there are many things that could be included. Some that they raised at the trial court that haven't been raised here, but by excluding them, they're not unfair in this case because the description that was made by the General Assembly is a fair and sufficient summary to put the voters on notice. Because, contrary to walking across the gym, the provision is available at all the polling sites, as well as the fair ballot language.
But that's not our question. Is the summary fair and accurate? Now, can they go read the entire?
Right. I agree, Your Honor. But recognizing the context of elections, that they are available, and this is within the context of the case law, that the summary statement is intended to provide notice of the purpose, not to give all the details, not to speculate about what the legal conclusions might be or how it might be applied and some of those things. So.
We know that the ballot titles are supposed to be printed in the newspaper as well as the text. Right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where that's been done and where it hasn't been done?
There's nothing in the record as to where that's been done, but by statute, it's required to be done. I assume it either has been done or will be done shortly.
And is there any way of knowing whether where it's been done, it can be redone?
It can
be reprinted with new language?
Yeah, and it would have to be in 140 or more election located, or not 140, many locations throughout the state. So I don't know. I suppose
I think
it's
some of
possible.
Your co-counsel want to have a moment.
Sorry, no.
Thank you very much. Judge Stith, I did want to address the question that you asked earlier dealing with the primary election discussion. This court's addressed that issue in Nixon versus Blunt, which was on a slightly different set of facts, but really is the cardinal case that says the 6 week is really a drop-dead date. That was an August primary. That was, as far as a fact pattern, as a measure goes through, almost identical to this. It was passed towards the end of session. The governor set it on an August primary. The Secretary of State in that case said, I'm not going to put it on the ballot until I get the proper documentation from the General Assembly. This court ultimately ruled that the Secretary of State had to put it on the ballot because they did get notice in a sufficient fair amount of time, but that the six-week window was pretty much inviolate.
It seemed to assume that it applied here.
And in fact, I think that the majority opinion in that case said the statutes note that the courts are free, the word was actually to freely give authority to make changes in the ballot until 6 weeks before the election, which I think certainly implies, if not just flat out states, that after 6 weeks there's no authority to change the language in the ballot. And that's what Cole versus Carnahan, which was the Western District case, adopted and set forward, and I think is the reason in which the trial court...
But wasn't that dicta in Cole, though? I mean, that wasn't necessarily the holding.
Well, it was not the primary holding, because actually the primary holding was, I believe, to Judge Tideman's question, whether it could be vacated. Because the plaintiffs in Cole, in the lower court, had filed a ballot challenge seeking to have the language rewritten. When they went up on appeal, they changed their argument and said, we'd rather have it taken off the ballot. The court in that case, citing a long line of opinions, said there's no authority to take it off the ballot because you're on a 116-190 challenge. It's a purely creature of statute, and the only relief for that is certification of a new ballot title. And then the court went on to say, even if you were pursuing the 116-190 challenge, which you started, and which is the reason we're actually here, you can't change the ballot title because the Supreme Court's addressed that issue. And I think that when you look at that history, the mootness... We spent, I think the appellants spent their entire time discussing the substance of the measure. But in the end, you have to determine whether you can even make a change on the ballot or whether it's moot by operation. And there's an alternate remedy. There is the remedy of election contest. It's a high burden. I don't dispute that it's a high burden. But the fact that the burden is different doesn't mean that there's not a remedy.
Because in effect, you're saying that it's impossible to challenge prior to... If something's initiative is passed, is set for the ballot in this legislative session and the legislature determines the summary, there's never going to be more than a couple of weeks to challenge it, and that's inadequate as occurred here under your interpretation.
Well, because of the governor picking the August date, it becomes a much shorter time frame. It's not that appellants could not have gotten it here in time. Theoretically, they could have gotten it done in time. They didn't get it done in time. Now, that's because of the court docket and other reasons, but theoretically, they could get it here in time. Again, going back to the original Senate joint resolution, it says the November ballot. There are a number of other ones going on the November ballot, and they are going to wind
their way
through
litigation. But the governor has the authority to choose the ballot, not the legislature.
He does, although I don't believe that the governor's authority actually says primary. He can set it for a primary election. It says a special election or the general, but this court's addressed that in some concurring opinions in the past. We do disagree on the remedy, but I don't think you need to get to the remedy in this case, and we've outlined that in our brief, because it's a pretty high burden. First, you have to say that it's not moot and that there is an opportunity to change it. Then you have to find that the summary statement is unfair and insufficient, and it is fair, it is sufficient, and I know that my co-counsel would like to have a few minutes, and I'd like to cede that time to.
Now, let me ask you one quick question. I remember in 92, there was a ballot initiative, and above the, they drew a line. Somehow, I think this initiative was taken out by this court, I believe. And they it was on the ballot. The ballot was there, but they drew a line through the initiative.
And I believe, I'm not sure which year it was, but that was the year there was a substantive challenge to the actual initiative itself. I think that was Missourians to Protect the Initiative Process versus Blunt, if I recall correctly, where this court ruled that the measure itself was going to be unconstitutional because it contained multiple subjects, it had ethics reform, it had the composition of the General Assembly, and as a result, that even if it had passed, it would be invalid. It was not the ballot title challenge, which is what we're here on.
But
we're
went
not
beyond
on
the time, and they drew a line through it on the ballot that people had.
They did, Your Honor, but it was a unique situation where they said the entire measure is is constitutionally infirm, and therefore it cannot go into effect regardless of what happens.
Thank you. Just quickly, I figure there's a reason that I'm here as a named defendant under the statute, and that is as a sponsor of the legislation. And what this does is it really brings in line the language in the Missouri Constitution with Heller and McDonald, which even in the Richard case, which Judge Teitelman penned, this court, even at that time in 2009, acknowledged that the U.S. Supreme Court had never found at that point that the individual or that the right applied to the states, and that's a source of a dissent in that opinion as well. And what this does is it really brings the Missouri Constitution in line with Heller and McDonald, and that's why the summary, and when you look at the summary, it's a summary. And Judge Stiff, as you said, arguably there was some time or some language left that we could have used, but you really don't have to repeat the entire ballot language in the summary if it'll fit. This court's never defined the standard that way. The standard is...
Well, you wouldn't say, you're saying the things you left out would have been improper detail?
No, not in proper detail, but not necessary for a summary under any interpretation that this court has ever held on what's necessary in a summary. And so when you look at the summary, number one, that it's an inalienable right, that comes straight from Heller. That is from the Heller where basically the court finally said this is not contingent on a militia, on anything else. This is an individual right, and the court said it is a right of the highest regard. And under any constitutional standard, that restriction in D.C. was unconstitutional.
Ms. Follett argues that because it uses the term the right, that erroneously indicates to the voters it's the same right that they have previously enjoyed, and that that is misleading.
This court has specifically said that in a ballot summary, you can reference an existing right as a form of reference to inform the voter of what it is you're talking about, and we cite that in the brief, and that certainly is the case here. It is a right, but we are bringing the right in line should Missouri voters pass this in line with
the federal. She argues the right's being changed, so it's not...
Right, you have a disagreement with the appellants on this. One says it is a change, one says it's not a change. It is referencing an existing right to keep and bear arms and making changes to it with reference to the existing right, saying what those changes are to bring it in line with McDonald and Heller. And as Judge Teitelman said, you know, does anyone even know what unalienable or inalienable mean? Those terms are synonymous. If you look in Black's Law Dictionary, which I don't think any of us cited, they are interchangeable and they mean they cannot be sold, transferred, or subject to a vote. And so I think every fourth grader in the state of Missouri in a public school learns what an inalienable right is. I don't think any of them, unless they go to law school, know what strict scrutiny is.
So why isn't it a major change that previously, if you had a felony or if you were mentally incompetent and so forth, the legislature could pass legislation saying you're not...
And the legislature will still be able to do that.
But now they would be able to?
Absolutely, they'd be able to do that.
Okay. And so this doesn't really work a change in your view, just explains...
What it does is it keeps in line with Heller and McDonald to say it's an individual right that is unalienable. It gets the highest level of review from this court. And basically, you know, when this court is presented with those questions, and I can't speculate on those what would be, but it is going to be a decision for this court of what meets that standard and what does not. And just just like the language, removing the language that says shall not justify, this court has never once relied on upholding regulations on concealed carry, has never once cited that language, neither has the legislature.
Well, Brooks, of course, cited that language.
Well, it's clearly recognized now, as this court has said over and over again, it is clearly established by both this court and the United States Supreme Court that reasonable regulations are tolerable even under the right to keep and bear arms. That will continue to be the case.
And none of the briefs address this, but assuming I agreed with your argument that a lot of states which don't specify, but this shall not justify the wearing of concealed weapons, have inferred that you can reasonably regulate concealed weapons. Removing something that's already there, we often will say, does have a meaning, even if its lack of presence initially might not have.
I don't believe it does. I think that in the 1875 Constitution, I think that was a response to the Bliss line of cases, which came out of Kentucky in 1822, which basically was the absolutist view at the time that Kentucky and Tennessee had adopted, that you could not regulate concealed weapons, and that your ability to keep and bear arms was, you couldn't do anything, no regulation at all. Missouri ultimately did not subscribe to that, and I think that's why that language was put in the Constitution, to clearly articulate in the Missouri Constitution that Missouri was different than Kansas or than Kentucky and other states that followed that Bliss line of reasoning. But that was the late 1800s. No state follows that anymore, and has been clearly articulated numerous times by this court as well as the United States Supreme Court. That line of reasoning doesn't hold true anywhere. So really, at this point, it's really an anachronism.
what's your position on those ballots that have already been cast by absentee ballots and military ballots? What effect will they have?
I think, as we say in the brief, that in addition to the statutory language, that is a further reason why there's no why the remedy is inappropriate. They're asking for it's moot. Voters have already voted on this. And I don't think that anyone up here, at least I would hope not, is going to argue that we should disenfranchise military voters because somehow there's a question of whether or not the language is sufficient. The language, I believe, is sufficient. And getting back to the previous issue that Judge Teitelman raised, you know, as a lawyer and having litigated cases for 20 years, we can fight about the minutiae of this. But being in wearing the other hats that I wear, when you go out and talk to the public, they don't think like lawyers. And the question is, on sufficiency of the summary, are they put on notice that they are about to vote on something that has an impact on the right to keep and bear arms, and what does it do? And the language clearly, I believe, fairly and sufficiently articulates what that change is. And if they want to know further exactly what that language is, because it's understood that's just a summary, they have the ability to go to it. They're provided it by their local election officials, and they have the ability to read it at the poll. Thank you.
Any further questions?
By the time, we'd ask that the court rule for respondents. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Hatfield, what about the issue that these ballots are printed and done by local election authorities and none of them have been named as parties here? Why isn't your case moot? Because there could be no order entered against them that would even grant either of the forms of relief that you are.
Thompson versus Committee on Legislative Research, where this court ordered the Secretary of State to have stricken from the ballot portions of a summary statement and ordered the Secretary of State to inform the local election authorities to do so.
Were there local election authority parties named in that case?
There were not. And this court, I probably shouldn't do this, I happened to be here when this court was trying to figure out what to do, and Judge Karen Mitchell stood here and had this discussion with the court. And what the court said is, we're not going to allow people to vote on incorrect and improper language. You figure it out. And they ordered the Secretary of State, and if you read that opinion at the end, they say, to reiterate, which I haven't seen in this court's opinions very often, to reiterate, Secretary of State, you shall do this. You shall do this in the future. Now, and Your Honor, you didn't quite ask this question, but Senator Schaefer talked about the disenfranchisement issue and whether we count the votes. That's not before the court today. If this measure passes 70 to 30, it won't matter. If this measure fails 70 to 30, it won't matter. If it's close, it's going to matter, and we may be back. But today, it doesn't matter. Incidentally, it was the Attorney General who first raised the issue that these votes might not count in arguing against a TRO. When the Dotson plaintiffs said we should stop the ballots going out now and take time to fix this, and the Attorney General told the Circuit Court, do not do that, some of these ballots may not count. And as we say in our reply brief, the court specifically relied on that representation from the Secretary of State and the Attorney General in denying our request to stop this problem before the train started rolling. Let me just mention a couple of things. Senator Schaefer talked about Heller versus McDonald and how this was just bringing the Missouri Constitution in line with Heller versus McDonald. I disagree, but that may have been the case as the bill was originally introduced. SJR 36, as introduced, legal file 035, did not add a strict scrutiny standard. All it said was, inalienable, state shall enforce, and it removed the carry and conceal. It did not introduce a strict scrutiny standard. But as the bill moved through the process, the legislature added words, which we know this court teaches us means they were doing something. And they added the words that everything shall be subject to strict scrutiny, but no one went back and fixed the title.
And so is it your argument that if strict scrutiny or highest level of review, whatever language, were added to it, that would be adequate?
Would it be adequate? Uh-huh. I believe it would more accurately describe the purposes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Depending on how the court chose to write it, and this is a whole nother discussion, there may be other things that need to go in there. I've lost like all my time. Judge Breckenridge asked, is it significant that the General Assembly wrote it? And I agree with Ms. Vollett that for purposes of analyzing whether it's fair and sufficient, it is not significant. However, this court should be aware that this is the only time that we allow the proponent of an initiative petition to write their own summary statement. The General Assembly is the only ones who have the authority to put a commercial on the ballot for the thing they wrote. The people who have reserved the right to amend the Constitution through the initiative petition process cannot do that.
So unlike Amendment 3, the Secretary of State does not have any authority to change this?
Under, I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Unlike Amendment 3 in 2000.
Oh, that's correct, Your Honor. And that's an important point, too. The General Assembly had an option here. They could write their own ballot title, commercial for what they wrote, or they could allow the Secretary of State to do it. They chose to take the risk of writing a ballot title, knowing that they had also given you the right to review it. By statute, the right to review it is insufficient and unfair. If you don't review it, no one can. The governor doesn't get to veto a joint resolution. The system is set up to allow you, to beg you, to entitle you to review this summary statement as to whether it's insufficient.
I know you're about to, you're over time, but you didn't address the mootness argument. Can you address that and how a statute prohibits the adding of candidates or issues to the ballot? How does that apply here? Or is that Ms. Vollett? I don't want to.
Well, it's Ms. Vollett, but let me just say that that's the reason we publish it in the paper, is so that if it's wrong, it can be corrected.
Mr. Hatfield, before you sit down, or maybe Ms. Vollett, in Thompson, there was a lot of evidence at the trial court about the voting mechanisms around the state, how many different people used voting booklets at that time and scan ballots. Almost everyone has now moved to an optical scan ballot where everybody sends the whole text of the ballot through the scanner.
Right.
Was there any evidence in this case at the trial court about the voting mechanisms around the state or how a paster that was used in Thompson would work or not work with those scanners?
There was not. So the argument in this case has been that this case is de jure moot. There is no factual record that suggests it's moot.
Is there any way for us to know whether there's a mechanism that would work?
I don't know that there is. I would suggest that, as in Thompson, if you believe it's insufficient and unfair, you attempt to do something about it. If for some reason the local election authorities cannot correct it, which is a physical possibility, I suppose, we may have to deal with that at a later date if we have ballots out there that say different things. But given the way things work in the modern area, it's amazing what we could do in 4 weeks.
Mr. Hatfield, do you know exactly how many days you had between the time the governor actually signed the legislation and the mootness date occurred?
Well, Your Honor, we talk about, the Dotson plaintiffs discuss in our reply brief that under the state's interpretation, or somebody's interpretation of mootness, a case will be moot before it's ripe. The reason we got here when we did, the reason we got to the trial court before 60 days is because everyone double-timed it. Secretary of State issued their certification early. Auditor issued their summary statement early. We filed suit on the afternoon of the day that the secretary certified the initiative. We were in court on the next business day. Your Honor, if this case is moot, I don't know what else to do for my clients. I have to tell you my perspective on that. There was nothing else I could have done. And to hold that this statute moots us out is to disenfranchise people and deny the certain remedy for all injuries that the Constitution guarantees us. Sorry to preach there right at the end. Ms. Vollett.
I think it's very important for this court to look carefully at the plain language of 115.125.2 on whether this is moot. It says a court may not order an issue to be placed on the ballot. Changing the title does not affect the underlying measure on which the people would vote. It does not place a new issue. It would change the title, how it appears on the ballot, but a vote cast for, a majority of votes cast for, is on the same question, underlying question. It would change the law in the same way, regardless of the title.
And what do you think the legislators' intent was when they wrote this years ago, before all the technology we have today? Was it to, you know, protect the local clerks when they're printing the ballots, to be able to have something? They wouldn't have to be changing the printing press and having new additions as ballots closer to election day?
I would urge the court to look at 115.125.2 in its entirety. This particular sentence appears after another sentence that talks about adding new things at the behest of political subdivisions. They're thinking about that, and then it says the court may not order an issue or person or candidate, I don't have the text in front of me, to be placed on the ballot. So they're thinking about situations where courts had ordered late past municipal regulations. And those are the two cases that this court has referenced that statute. We cited them in our reply brief and discussed it, and it was a candidate being added. It was a situation where there was a candidate that was added. In that case, it was more than 6 weeks before the deadline. The court said that's fine. That 115.125.2 doesn't, that time limit doesn't apply because we were more than that time. And then the other one was in the Blunt case, and it was there you were talking about a new issue going on the ballot. So we were within the terms of 115.125. This is would not add something new. So that's why I don't believe that it applies under its plain terms. I also think that if the title does not comply with 116.155.2, requiring the stating the purposes of the measure, if it is voted on by the people, I do not believe that it would be constitutionally validly enacted, because under the Constitution, amendments are to be submitted by ballot titles as provided by a law. 116.155.2 says that titles must state the purposes in fair and sufficient language. I'm paraphrasing slightly. That's mandatory. There is no time limit on when that. They must state that in a mandatory way. And so a measure that is purporting to be submitted to the people that falls below that standard, I do not believe is being submitted by a ballot title as required by law.
Opposing counsel says that can be, if it's within 6 weeks, it's too late before the election, it can be addressed after the election.
I don't know where there, I mean, there's no text statutory provision that says that, and I think the court should look at the statute. And as Your Honor pointed out, the legislature knew in other circumstances when you could say you shouldn't do certain things, and they didn't do that here. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken under submission.